This is Tuesday, October 18th, and this is the Reading Odyssey call. Okay. So would anyone like to jump in?
Well, I was the one thing that struck me about the difference in Achilles' death was the whole myth around the Achilles' heel, but yet the way he died in Ovid wasn't by a arrow in his heel. So I just thought that struck me when I read it as something you'd always heard and something that was always reiterated, and but it's not in Ovid.
Yeah, I was interested in seeing the same thing as well, the confirmation of the heel, which we didn't get here. It didn't say he wasn't hit in the heel. It just was a very quick death, like shot an arrow, Achilles is dead. Not a lot of detail, unfortunately.
I think that's kind of typical of Ovid, though. I mean, it's more poetry and not heavy on the detail of these stories. There's almost like a presumption that the reader really knows these stories quite well, because if you don't, you have to find other sources to fill in the gaps, I think.
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, though, there's that whole story about the centaurs and that whole wedding scene.
Yeah.
Which actually, to me, very much like the a lot like in the Iliad, you have these long, very graphic battle scenes, and that the centaur scene at the wedding was very much like the Iliad in that regard, but the Iliad piece was very different. It just read for me, it stood out for being so different than everything else in the book, but yet so much like what we'd read in the Iliad.
And it is odd because of the detail in it, and it's really quite gruesome also, which, you know, some of the stories we've experienced have been a bit that way, but that seemed to be much more so, I thought.
I don't think there's anything else in Ovid that was quite like it. Have we read anything like that in Ovid?
Not so far, I don't think.
I don't think so either. Yeah, no, I thought that was... It almost was like this book was veering off in a different direction, and it almost to me came out of nowhere in a way too. It was just like all of a sudden, it was just very, very violent and gruesome, and the detail in which he described, you know, people being smashed in the head and the brains coming out of the eyes and the nose. Or, I mean, it was just very, very detailed and gruesome, and I don't remember anything quite like it.
It's confusing, too, unless you knew the name, the centaur, and who wasn't.
I did. I got confused of who was killing who and who, like, what side was winning or who was, like, I didn't know. I kept looking in the back on the glossary of names to see if it would say whether they were a centaur or, you know, who they were so I could figure out, because I couldn't figure, I did not know that. But I was thinking as I was reading it that, you know, what we've been told is these stories are handed down, and people would know whom he was talking about, and we don't know that because we don't have that history.
What was interesting, though, is also the timing. So you have this story about the centaurs and the humans battling in this wedding, which I at least thought was very much like the writing of Homer in the Iliad, and then it goes right into the story of the death of Achilles.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like it's almost like his little mini version of the Iliad. And then it leads in the death of Achilles. I don't know if I'm just imagining that or if there is some deeper purpose there. Unfortunately, I don't have anyone who can really comment on that, but it really struck me that way.
Maybe we should get into some favorite passages if people want to talk about
that. I was going to suggest that.
Oh, since there's a silence. Well, since we're kind of in that area, I'll start. I think Elizabeth wrote in, and she had remarked on this also. On page 362, under the heading, The Fall of Troy,
I was really moved by the description of the ravages of the war and the effect on the women. And some of the language in particular was just really compelling, I felt like. So maybe I'll share that passage. So if we go to 362 to around line 490.
Okay.
Talking about, it's kind of long, hopefully you guys will tolerate this. So Jupiter's altar had drunk Priam's thin stream of blood, and Cassandra, priestess of Apollo, was stretching her unavailing arms to heaven as she was being dragged by the hair. The Trojan women thronging the half-burnt temples and clutching the statues of their country's gods while they still could were carried off by the conquering Greeks as valuable prizes. Astyanax was thrown down from the tower where he used to stand with Andromache, as she pointed out to him his father Hector, fighting for him and his ancestral kingdom. The north wind picks up, filling the sails with a favorable breeze. It's time to go. The Trojan women kiss their native soil. Troy, farewell. We are leaving against our will. The last to board was Hecuba. The pitiful thing was found among the tombs of her sons, clinging to their graves, trying to kiss their remains. Ulysses dragged her away, but not before she emptied one tomb, clutching at her breast the ashes of Hector. The urn lay empty, and on the grave of her son, she left an offering, a few wisps of gray hair and tears. It just seems like, it could be equally appropriate to modern time and the effects of war and how there's so many circles of sorrow, that permeate from where battles are held and things like that. I just felt like that language was very touching and beautiful.
And I found in not only the two books for tonight, but the three books from last month that we didn't get to talk about, I also found some of the language I thought was just very, very beautiful and descriptive. And two passages that I really thought were so descriptive and you could really picture it was on page 311 in book 11, when he's talking about the storm and the ship fighting the storm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and just how, about line 575 or so, a little later than that, but heavy waves slap down, waves, thunder crashes, the sea seems to run up to the sky itself and touch the scudding clouds with its salt spray. Now the waves turn up yellow sand from the bottom. Now they are blacker than the waters of Styx, and then flatten out with whitened with hissing foam. The Thracian ship is subject to all these sea changes. Now she seems to stare from a high mountaintop down into deep valleys in Acheron's pit. And when the sea lowers her into the deep trough, she seems to gaze up at heaven from the abyss of hell. And then it just keeps going on. The ship's sides boom as thudding waves strike with the force of a battering ram, a projectile launched by a catapult into a fortress. And it just goes on to the next page. And I just felt reading that whole section, just how you could imagine being there. You could hear it all and you could see it all. And I just thought it was very powerful.
I noted that as well, Nan. I thought that was a really beautiful passage. I happen to really love the ocean, though, too, so that could have something to do with it.
Well, I do, too. So
maybe that's it. Yeah, because even later on, around 594, let's take a look there. And then I said 636, so let me... So 6:30, somewhere in this vicinity, it says he longs for her. He's glad she's absent, talking about six. He would love to look back at his native shores and turn his last gaze in the direction of home, but he has no idea where he is, for the sea seethes in a maelstrom, and the pitch-black clouds hide all the sky and double night's darkness. Yeah, I felt it was really beautiful. What do you guys think about that, you men on the call?
This is one of my favorite sections as well. It really translates. It's, saying the vision and, the cries of the sailors. And it's very much, it's almost movie-like, in terms of how you're able to imagine it from his language.
Mm-hmm. And likewise,
a little bit later on that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just
saying a little bit later. I'll stop. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that I just love the visual, how everything just kind of draws up these visual. It's so evocative. So I was just going to add that.
Were there any particular sections of it that Stephen and Joshua that you liked?
This particular passage?
Yeah, like particular language that struck you within that?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm not reading a book. I don't have a physical book, so I have to, like, find it.
Oh, no, that's what I'm saying.
It's so hard with Kindle. Because it becomes pages and passages, and I have no idea where you are. I have to actually do a quick search and find it.
Oh, yeah, that's true. It is really hard on those.
Even the band where you listen.
I think next time I'm going to get the book. Instead of using it, it's just too difficult.
Even after the portion you liked, I just thought that next section, so this is line 640, where one last wave, like a victor gloating over his spoils, coils itself high, pauses to look down at the other wave, and then, as if Athos and Pindus were torn from their foundations and thrown into the sea, falls on the ship with overwhelming force and plunges it all the way down to the bottom. The description there was, I thought, again, very powerful.
And almost like, you know, a living creature in itself, which really the ocean is if you understand the ocean at all. But that's one thing in Ovid that, especially in this Lombardo translation, where I feel like kind of the personification of nature is really, I really love that. I mean, I grew up in Oregon in like primordial forests, and so I just love nature, and I'm like starving here in the desert in Phoenix. And so some of these descriptions of making nature more human-like are just really powerful to me.
But what I also liked, it was just almost the complete opposite, is the next page. So starting on page 314, line 690, when he starts describing sleep's abode and how he is, and it's so different from the crashing and the destruction that was just a page ago, and it's very languid and misty, and he switches gears so quickly, but it's just, I felt just as powerful reading about sleep's abode and what it looks like and how sleep is, you know, lying on his bed and in this languid pose. And I liked that as the other passage. I just thought it was so descriptive. You could imagine it, you could feel it, and it was so opposite of what he had just written.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, that those lines beginning at 690, it's actually a straight translation from the Odyssey, when he goes to the land of the Sumerians, which is always shrouded in cloud. Just those first three lines. I don't know if anybody saw Metamorphosis on stage.
I haven't.
They dramatized the death of these this king and his wife, and they dramatized the part where, you know, Iris goes to visit sleep. And it was really effective because the god of sleep is presented as this almost comic character, you know, who can barely wake up. And then he sends Morpheus to imitate the king. And then, of course, the actual play, the king walks out, you know, sopping wet. And suddenly it's all sober. And then the king just the god of sleep just sort of laughs and says, oh, that's really good. You know, and then the rest of it goes on. But it was a really effective piece of drama.
Sounds like it.
Yeah. Phil asked me to do one thing. I'm sorry to interrupt. He asked me if I could find out who's on the call.
So it's Nan. It's Joshua, Stephen, Nan, and Cherie.
Joshua?
Is there anyone else?
Scott.
Stuart.
Scott.
Stephen, Nan, and I'm sorry, Joshua, Stephen, Nan, and
Stuart.
I'm sorry,
Scott.
Scott?
Stuart?
Yeah.
Oh.
And Therese.
And
did you get
Therese.
Stuart?
Yes.
No, I didn't. Thank you. And Stuart. Thank you. I'm very sorry to interrupt.
No problem. Does anybody else want to talk about their favorite passage in either last month or this month? Because we kind of went back to last month with book with the crash.
This is Josh. I you know, one of the things that I found most interesting, this is going way back to book 9, and on page 261, and Bill had the same passage in the email he sent earlier, but I think his take on it was a somewhat different one. So this is where Iante is lamenting the fact that she was born a female because she's not the woman. And there's a section starting on line 839, or even going down a little more, we're starting with the heifers. It's on page 261. You know, heifers do not burn with love for heifers, nor mares for mares. No, rams go for sheep, and does fellow stags. Birds make like this too, and so do all animals. No female desires another female. I wish I'd never been born. Sure, Creta produced every monstrosity, and Pasiphae did make love to a bull, but that was male and female, so that's obviously okay. My passion is clearly even more insane. She had her bull by being disguised as a heifer, and the male lover was one taken in. What was interesting to me about this passage is the contrast between the female homosexuality and the male homosexuality, not only in Ovid, but in the other books that we've read, both the histories and poetry. So, like, this is, if you go to page 269, there's around line 88, talking about Orpheus, 87. And it says, you know, it was Orpheus who began the custom among Thracian men of giving their love to tender young boys and enjoying that brief springtime of blossoming youth. There seems to be at least a tolerance, if not outright acceptance, for male homosexuality. But the female sexuality is being described as so abhorrent in contrast. And I
picked up on that as well.
I don't know how
that concept. We kind of touched on this, possibly when we were discussing Livy, because not that I am particularly interested in pederasty, but here I go again. I think in the Greek culture, pederasty, which was the love of an older man with an adolescent boy, was quite common because it was kind of a cherished kind of love between them, where the older person would admire the beauty of the younger person, and the younger person would benefit from the wisdom and guidance and mentoring of the older person. And I think in Plato, I couldn't pinpoint which of his books, but it's discussed there as a particular form of love within Greek culture. Maybe that is why it's viewed differently from even possibly homosexuality amongst, you know, two older men or, you know, as you say, amongst two women. But I don't know for sure. I know that we did get some input from Professor Cartledge about that, but I'm not sure it specifically addressed your question. Do you recall that, Nan? Do you remember that?
Yes, I do, somewhat. But I do think when we were doing the Odyssey, I think, though, wasn't it in some of the other histories, there always did seem to be, like, in fact, even, I want to say, Achilles, like, they all had these special friendships and they were accepted, and even if they were same age, that there were always these, and I think I remember in one of the histories, there was, you know, talk about soldiers and their favored people and their pets and things like that. And I picked up on the same thing when I read book 9, that, you know, they talk about the, you know, love of boys and love of men, but the woman is, you know, I'm insane, I'm a monster, and it just seems to go with the whole role of women in that society is a lesser being and more, you know, weren't given the same rights.
Yeah, or possibly I could see them perceiving women as incapable of understanding the import of such a relationship or something like that, maybe, given that, I mean, they were admired for their weaving and things like that. So, I don't know. That's interesting. That's an interesting point.
There's been plenty of other love stories between where women pine for male lovers in the book. I don't know.
That's accepted.
That's accepted.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Until they both get turned into dogs or whatever the gods have in store for them.
Yeah.
This is sort of kind of related in terms of interesting passages. The one in terms of sex change, the one in the Battle of the Centaurs, where they confront Canis and say, "Well, you were a woman before. You can't, you know, you're not going to be very strong or fight." And it turns out that this Canis is, look at page 340, 341, and this Canis turns out to be, you know, such a fierce opponent that they have to sort of bring down the mountain on top of him in order to kill him. I mean, I thought that was kind of interesting, you know, because the centaurs keep taunting him, page 543. "What are you doing here, Canis? You'll always be a woman to me, Canis. Don't you remember what you were born as, or what you did to get this phony look of a man? Think about your natural sex and the rape you suffered, and go pick up your distaff and basket of wool. Go spin thread with your thumb and leave war to men." And then, of course, Canis ends up killing all of them. So.
Well, Canis was invincible. Canis couldn't be, was unaffected by any sort of weapon thrown at him, right? Wasn't that part of
right.
it?
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's why they had to bring the mountain down on him.
Yeah.
Right.
They suffocated him.
Yeah.
That's interesting, but also that kind of reflects a sort of lack of respect or even, towards women. The fact that Canius is this invincible soldier, and yet because he started as a woman, he should go spin his wool around his thumb. That's interesting.
Yet there seems to be a sort of special place for people who have experienced both sexes, you know, sort of like Tiresias, you know. It wasn't Tiresias, both sexes or something?
Yeah. Yeah, he had experienced both and then got in trouble with Juno for saying that it was better for women? Isn't that what he said?
Yeah, I don't remember this, but that's it, yeah.
What's strange to me about that passage is it's almost, as people have said, it's like it's monster. It's almost like when Mira is talking about her passion for her own father, not just that it's bizarre, but that it's unknown, which is,
right.
You know, which is hard to... Her, you know, like Sappho was an admired figure in the ancient world. I mean, it's hard for me to believe that it was. That's what's so strange, that it could be portrayed as something just like, not just weird but unknown.
Maybe that
yeah.
was just Ovid's
yeah.
take on it for some reason.
I'm not sure you portrayed it as unknown, because he did mention, I think, that there are laws against it.
Right. Presumably, you wouldn't have to have laws against it if it was unknown.
Nonetheless, unacceptable. Yeah.
Someone brought up the story of the girl who was in love with her father, and didn't she like trick him into sleeping with her?
Yes.
Yes, that was Mira. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, and that couple, I just felt like in 9, 10, 11, there was, or yeah, I think that's where we're at. Again, women were portrayed poorly, and they were the schemers, and they were the ones that were doing things immoral or illegal, and, you know, I don't know, I just thought it was a very almost misogynist view in those books, and it was almost starting to get to me a bit, because it's like, you know, women are always the ones that are wrong, women are the ones that are always doing these horrible things, and it's not always our fault.
A different era.
Yes.
Yeah, and, you know, the trickery of women. The women are always up to trickery, like the nurse of Mira helping her scheme against her father in this abhorrent act. Yeah.
And then wasn't there also a one who was in love with her brother?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's all the, it was always the female who was the one, so you had the one in love with her father, the one in love with her brother, you had the one who was a lesbian, and they were all these horrible people.
I guess the men were
I think Mira is at least portrayed with some sympathy. You know, she fights against it, mm-hmm. and it's too strong for her. You know, and then she undergoes this horrible, you know, this horrible fate.
Yeah.
Since we're talking about that story, I noted just a couple lines that I thought were really great. So on page 282, line 535, let me get there.
Sorry, I'm on Kindle too. What book is that?
Oh, it's book 10. Well, and I'll read it to you. So it says, the father receives his own flesh in his bed and tries to calm down the frightened girl, encouraging her and calling her baby, just as at some point she calls him daddy. He's like, oh my God. And then on line just a little bit farther down, it says, so that the names would play a part in their sin. She went from the chamber full of her father, carrying in her womb desecrated seed and immaculate conception. I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really quite a story. I don't know, but how does that happen? How do you fall in romantic love with your father? How does that happen? It must have had to do with the gods. It wasn't her fault.
Yeah, but yeah, it doesn't really say. It just...
Anybody else have any favorite passages?
Well, something else I thought was, again, a kind of a shift gears midway through was in book 13, page 376. It was Polyphemus' song to Galatia. And it started off, I thought, this is going to, he was a Cyclops who was, you know, in love with Galatia, but she was in love with somebody else. And it sounded like it was going to be this really nice kind of love poem. And, you know, whiter than privet petals and slimmer than an alder, more in bloom than a meadow, friskier than a kid, more radiant than crystal and smooth. I'm like, oh, how wonderful. Why does someone say that to me, you know? And then, the next stanza or paragraph, however you want to phrase it, wilder than an untamed heifer, harder than old oak, more slippery than water, tougher than willow or twisting vines, more stubborn than cliffs, roiling more than a river. And it gets nastier and meaner than a pregnant bear, pricklier than thistles, deafer than the sea. And I'm thinking, okay, you're trying to win this woman and this is what you say to her? And it just threw me that it went from this very nice kind of love psalm to this you're a horrible person, basically.
Well, because you reject it. Yeah.
But it's just in the one. Yeah, I just, you know, I was waiting for this wonderful love story, and it
from a cyclops.
He started off so well. But then I didn't understand. The one thing that threw me was softer than the swan's down, which I understand, or curdled milk. I didn't know, like, curdled milk to me is, that threw me, like, softer than curdled milk? Like,
maybe you don't want to go there, Nan.
You're saying these lines wouldn't work on you.
The first few would have, the last ones wouldn't have.
I like how he then tried to sell himself about all he had. Like, I have most of a mountain with deep caves where you don't feel the heat of the sun in summer nor winter's cold. I have apples weighing down their branches, golden grapes. Like, he just keeps selling her and all that he has. I'm like, that does sound pretty good. It's too bad you just have that one big eye on your forehead.
And then too bad you had that one, you know, paragraph above it where you just kind of...
Yeah. Your vicious nature. Too bad about that, right. And
so
wasn't
it was a weird way to try to win someone.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I know exactly. But wasn't Polyphemus the same Cyclops that was throwing huge boulders at Odysseus and his crew when they landed near where he lived? Wasn't in the Odyssey? Was he the same Cyclops, or who was quite famous?
Like,
yeah. Anyway, never trust a Cyclops.
This is the same Cyclops.
It is the same one.
Yes, same one.
Yeah, it said, I just went to the glossary of names, and it says killed Acis and members of Ulysses' crew.
Yeah, he was pretty nasty.
Yeah, but maybe he hadn't killed them yet. Because then didn't Odysseus stab out his eye?
Yes, he did. But that was after he started to eat the crew.
Can't hear you?
That was after he started to eat the crew. You know, they were imprisoned in his cave. And,
right.
And,
right, but didn't Odysseus blind him?
Yeah, but only, I mean, you know, only after they'd started
to eat the crew. I'm not saying he was wrong to blind him. I'm just saying this had to have been before he ate Odysseus' crew because he still had his eye.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. We didn't know he was a horrible person at this point in time is all I was trying to say.
Right.
Does anybody else have anything that?
Well, you know, one thing that was, I think, if you want a positive story about women, well, at least a positive portrayal of a woman, though it doesn't end positively, is the story of Polyxena. She was she's the one that was the daughter of Hecuba, who the Greeks sacrificed at Achilles' behest.
Uh-huh.
He came back and said, you know, after he was dead, his shade came back and said, hey, you have to kill her to make my ghost happy. And then she died a very honorable death, to the point that the Greeks are themselves crying as they kill her. But she at least is portrayed very nobly.
Yeah.
Or find where that story is.
She was very brave, yeah. Uh, 363, I think, is where that is, if you want to go from there. I think I had a note on that.
All right, there she is.
Yeah.
There's not a specific passage, unless you have a passage of favor. I just found that story. A beautiful story.
Yeah, her speech is on page 364 at the bottom.
Someone want to read that?
Yeah, well, 350, I mean, it's in that area. You know, avail yourself of my noble blood. Go ahead. No need to wait. Just sink your sword deep in my throat and my breast. And she bared her throat and her breast. Polyxena will not be a slave to any man. Nor will you placate any god with a rite such as this. I only wish that my mother not know of my death. My mother diminishes my joy in death, but my death should not be as dreadful to her as her own life.
all I ask, if my request is just, is that you move away so that I may go freely in this Phygian shades. Do not let a man's hand touch my virgin flesh. My blood, pure and free, will be more acceptable to whoever it is you're trying to appease by slaughtering me. And if my last words will move any of you, the daughter of Priam, no captive, asks you, return my body to my mother on ransom. Let her pay with tears, not gold, for the sad rite of burying me. She paid with gold when she could.
So sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a beautiful path. The paragraph afterwards is also very beautiful. And she was very brave. She just accepted it as something she needed to do.
Well, not necessarily that she had to do, but again, I stuck on the line, I will not be a slave to any man. So she was thinking death is better than the lot in her life would be. Because she even says, you know, this right is, you won't placate any god with this. And if my blood is pure and free, it'll be more acceptable to whoever it is you're trying to appease. So it wasn't like she accepted it in the sense that she knew it was the right thing to do. But it was more, my life will be better in death than living in this world. To me, that's how I took it, that she could.
No, I think you're right, Nan. Because you're right, because also when you go a little bit earlier, it says, with her mother's sole consolation was torn from her arms, an ill-fated girl, braver than any grown woman. She was led to Achilles' funeral down there to become a sacrificial victim. She never forgot who she was. So you're right, yeah. I still felt like she was brave, though.
Oh, she was. Yeah, I don't deny that, but it wasn't that she accepted it, but it was.
Yeah, I think you're right about that.
Is there anything else anybody wants to talk about?
Did anyone want to hearken back to, and I personally am not prepared to do this, but one of Phil's initial talking points was the difference in between the Greeks and the Romans and their perception of Ulysses. Do any of you have anything you want to say about that?
I didn't think Ulysses was that. I mean, the basic idea was the same basic clever Ulysses. It's just that he needed a lot more to defend himself verbally, to talk about all the things he had done, whereas he was more of a sort of clever actor in the Iliad and the Odyssey. It didn't seem to me to be a totally different character. You know, and he sort of, Ovid, you know, even says, well, he gave a great speech. So I don't know. I didn't see it as being, you know, that different, except for all the detail.
Where he had to describe his actions versus us just witnessing him doing them in the Iliad and the Odyssey.
Well, I wasn't aware. I don't remember the Iliad and the Odyssey, the Iliad in this case, that well. But I didn't remember all the things that he was describing that he had done. The list seemed to go on and on in terms of everything that he said. But I thought he gave a very effective argument on why he was a better choice than Ajax. I mean, I thought it was a pretty good debate. You know, he sort of discarded a lot of Ajax's arguments, I thought, quite well.
Am I wrong about this? Oh, go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Well, that's okay. Just that, you know, Ajax said, well, I'm a cousin and I'm, you know, a descendant of Jupiter, et cetera. And he seemed to be able to deal with all that stuff quite well. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, no, don't apologize. I interrupted you. The one thing that I'm thinking of, and I read the Odyssey quite some time ago, but, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that in the Odyssey, weren't there a couple references to the fact that he didn't consider himself a great orator or a person who was able to speak well, I guess, or persuasively? And then clearly here, if I'm right about that, then that would be a big difference, because clearly in Ovid, his speech was very eloquent and persuasive. Do you guys remember that from the Odyssey, where there were references about the fact that he didn't consider himself someone who spoke well or a good orator? Do you recall that? I can't remember for sure if it was him or someone else.
There's a famous, the Iliad, there's a famous passage in which Achilles, who actually speaks beautifully in the Iliad, says he can't make speeches the way Odysseus can. I think he's pretty consistently portrayed as a skillful speaker.
Okay.
Because a lot of the events that he talks about in his speech are not in the Iliad or the Odyssey, but some of them are.
Also, I don't know that it's a Greek versus Roman thing, because outside of the Iliad and the Odyssey, there are the Greek plays, and there's one, if I remember it correctly, Philoctetes, where he is kind of a scoundrel, he is more in the, in the vein of the character that's represented here, and that was a Greek play, so.
Even comes off differently just between the Iliad and the Odyssey, as I recall. It's been a while since I read both. But, there are a lot of times where you're kind of questioning what's he thinking. In the Odyssey, he's taking forever to get back home to rescue his wife and family from the suitors.
Well, wasn't that because of Athena?
It was, but he spent, 10 years? Was it Calypso?
It was like seven. But it's always hard in all these things to disentangle what the gods are doing versus what free will do the characters have. But he was away for 10 whole years. And he certainly seemed to have been enjoying himself a lot during certain parts of the journey.
Because I was looking through book 13 and I didn't see it, but I thought Ajax had even said that Ulysses is like a speaker and that he just uses words, and I can't find that now, so maybe I'm wrong.
That sounds familiar.
But I can't seem to find it.
Line 107, where was Ulysses then with all of his speeches, that kind of,
okay.
Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, but I also thought he said, that's part of it, but I also thought it was that, or maybe Ulysses says it, that I'm known, and maybe it was Ulysses who said it, but I thought there was something about how, I've always used my intelligence to your benefit, and my eloquence, such as it is, that now speaks for its owner, but has often been deployed in the past on your behalf. So it was that line, 160, on page 353. So it was Ulysses who said that about himself. So he's basically saying, I know how to talk, I know how to spin things.
But I'm unselfishly doing it on everybody else's behalf.
Is there anyone else? Somebody pointed out earlier, it's sort of like he's actually a much more constructive character in the Iliad than he is in the Odyssey.
And actually, I found what I was looking for on Ajax's speech. So on page 349, around line 13 or 14 or so, far safer to fight with lies than with your hands. I am less ready to speak as he is to act. And I am as much his master in war as he is mine in speech. So that's what I was looking for. So basically saying, almost like Ulysses is a politician and he'll just lie and say, he'll be smooth and glib and say what people want to hear. That's how I took it.
You really feel like Anderson Cooper should be moderating this, don't you? the two of them in that way, there was, in my mind, a slight parallel with that in current events.
Yes. Because
personalities.
Ulysses basically says, no, I think Ajax says, I protected the ships in the harbor from Hector or whatever, and then Achilles like, Ulysses says, he didn't do it, I did it. It's like, okay, well, who did? It's like we need the fact checkers after the debate.
And there's one point where Ulysses says, he's talking about how Ajax doesn't even understand the stuff that's on the shield.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-oh, it's on 359. Up there is this line, like 351. Or at least our 350, you know, that she gave her son a work at heavenly art to grace the shoulders of an oaf like this. If Ulysses talking about Ajax. He does nothing of what is carved on the shield, the sea, the lands, the stars in the deep sky, the Pleiades, the Hyades, the Great Bear, that is aloof from the sea, and opposite her Orion wheeling with his glittering sword. He's asking for armor he can't even understand. Making, you know, directly... Mm-hmm. Impugning Ajax's intelligence.
Not that Ajax felt he had to commit suicide after losing this debate.
It was rigged.
Yeah. Yeah, so no one but Ajax will be able to defeat Ajax.
Yeah.
I guess he wins.
I would say I'm taking my ball and going home.
You win. You killed yourself.
Well, it's almost 9:00. I don't know if anybody else wants to add any final thoughts.
One final thought. One of the things I really enjoy about reading this whole book is I'm understanding more about the origins of certain words and terms that we use.
Mm-hmm.
Around, you know, Arachne and becoming the spider and how that ties in with the arachnids, or you know, Apollo's love for Hyacinth, who ends up dying, and he becomes a flower that we now know as a Hyacinth. That, you know, so many of the things we sort of take for granted in our language have origins in these myths.
Yeah. I've always loved that.
Yeah.
And actually, on another kind of off topic, I just read an article today on some kind of Halloween type words we can thank Charles Dickens for, which is kind of weird, but he was the first one to use the word like the creeps, like he gives me the creeps. So he was the first one to use that in his writing. So
did you see that?
Saw it online somewhere on Dickens. I'm a Dickens fan, so I don't remember exactly where it was. But it was because Halloween, it's some kind of like Anglophile website, I love Dickens, so, and since Halloween's coming, they had this article on it. The one thing I was hoping Andre or Phil would be on, but they're not, is on page 351. Line like 98. He was riding high when I knocked him on his ass, and I wanted to know what the original kind of how direct of a translation that was, because it's like something I just it just seemed so modern.
words.
That struck me also, Nan. That struck me too, Nan. I thought that was interesting.
So I was curious if that was just a translation for modern audiences to understand, or is that actually what he said or what he wrote?
This is Millie again. I wanted to thank everybody. If you have more, if you want to talk more, I don't want to interrupt. It's done. But you know, you should ask Phil that the next meeting. You should keep track of that question and ask.
Yep.
I'll
probably email it out.
That's a good idea. Email it out to him. But I wanted to thank everyone for participating and being here. Phil will be back on next time. But thank you for such a great discussion.
Thanks for filling in, Millie. That was nice of you.
Thank you. And I look forward to perhaps hearing more conversation in the future.
Okay.
Such a great discussion. You have a great night.
All right, thank you.
You too.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Are people still there?